Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, believing growth of Florida's economy depends on a diverse and inclusive workforce. The Able Trust works with the business community to include talented Floridians with disabilities as vital team members. More information is at abletrust.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
For the first time in 18 months, Florida conducts an execution, but that may not mean a tidal wave of more executions is imminent.
We all know any delay in any case is always an enemy to the ultimate successful prosecution of that case.
Also this week, in the wake of this week's execution, we'll talk with the reporter who produced that story on what may be the future of Florida's death penalty.
That, again, has never been used before in a lethal injection in the United States, and that's what they used to execute Mark Asay.
We'll also check out a campaign by Florida's House Speaker to do away with public financing of the state's political campaigns and say a final goodbye to a Florida lawmaker who had many friends on both sides of the political aisle. I'm Tom Flanagan, and this is Capitol Report. This week, the state of Florida executed its first convict in more than a year and a half. Capital punishment had been on hold since a major U.S. Supreme Court ruling found Florida's execution process was unconstitutional. Now, as we hear from member station WLRN's Wilson Sayer, more than 100 prisoners on death row are working to reduce their sentences.
The U.S. Supreme Court opinion came in January 2016 in the case of Hearst versus Florida.
It's been a roller coaster for us since Hearst came out.
Stephen Klinger is an assistant state attorney in Broward County. After the ruling, all Florida death penalty cases were put on hold while the courts tried to figure out how that decision could affect ongoing cases. After months of back and forth with the courts and legislature, the death penalty is back on the books with a few changes. Florida juries are now required to be unanimous in their decision to hand down a death penalty. Also, those juries now have the final say, not a judge like the way it used to be.
The original opinion out of the United States Supreme Court, then the following opinion that came out of the Florida Supreme Court, changed the way we've been doing things for 30 or 40 years in the past.
One of the biggest changes is that nearly 150 Florida death row inmates are now eligible for a new sentence, and the cases have started to pile up. Gene Zanobi is the regional counsel for Miami-Dade and Monroe counties. His office provides state-funded criminal defense, similar to what public defenders do. He'll represent a few of these death row inmates and says going back and trying to rebuild all these cases is going to be hard.
Families, witnesses, experts have to be found, have to be brought before the court. It takes time just getting that all together. It's a lift.
For the defense and prosecution, so far, the state attorney's office for Broward County has gotten back three cases to be resentenced. Sherry Tate is head of its homicide trial unit.
We have to pick a jury again, and this jury is, in most cases, they're going to need to hear the entire trial again so that they're educated on what the case was before we talk about penalty.
She says they have to go through each old case to see whether there's even enough to push for the death penalty again.
So you're reassembling all of that and doing it all over again. So sometimes these trials are weeks long, maybe months long.
We all know any delay in any case is always an enemy to the successful prosecution of that case.
Catherine Fernandez-Rundle is Miami-Dade County's state attorney.
Some of these cases are 20, 25 years old.
She says they're expecting 11 cases to come back for resentencing. In just one of those cases, she says there's 24 boxes of material. A new lawyer is going to have to learn everything that's in them. Another case has 90 witnesses. They all need to be found.
These lawyers are already overburdened. And now we have all these cases coming back, which are, you know, almost more difficult to put together than it is a fresher case.
She says retrying these cases is going to cost a lot of money. Retesting old evidence, paying for expert witnesses, and bringing people back into court to testify. She's hoping the state legislature will help pay. One of the things the Miami-Dade Circuit includes in their evaluation of whether to pursue the death penalty is the wishes of the victim's family. Fernandez-Rundle is concerned about the emotional toll of having to go through it all again.
How you can explain to, you know, Mrs. Angel, who I've met with so many times. This was that young little 18-year-old girl with her boyfriend. celebrating, and she and he are abducted.
She was raped, thrown out of the back of a van, and shot. Her boyfriend was stabbed repeatedly and left for dead. He survived.
Although I understand the legal decisions, of course, and that's the law, and we always honor the law, but how do I look at this mom and tell her, I know the justice system doesn't feel very judicious. You know, we're always duty-bound to the law and the evidence, but it's going to be a massive undertaking.
Florida inmates whose sentences were not affected by the U.S. Supreme Court decision are fighting for a shot at a new sentence. I'm Wilson Sayre in Miami.
We continue our look on what the future may hold as far as Florida's death penalty goes. Florida Public Radio's Nick Evans checked in with reporter Wilson Sayre after this week's execution of Mark Assay.
We are joined right now by Wilson Sayre, a reporter from WLRN who was at the execution. Tell me a little bit about what that was like.
Well, I've been to one other execution, and it seemed very similar to that. It was a little bit faster. It took 11 minutes for the whole process to happen. He had no last words, so the whole thing went really quickly. And this was a big test for a brand new lethal injection drug that's never been used in the United States before. And as far as we can see, given how Mr. Assay reacted to the drugs, it appeared as if it went as they hoped it would. The Department of Corrections hoped it would.
Okay, great. So I want you to tell me a little bit more about Mr. Assay. But first, let's talk some more about the three-drug cocktail. So lay out for me how, like, what the three drugs are, how they work in conjunction, and sort of the new elements in the process.
Yeah, so the way Florida does it, and there's a couple other states that do it this way, the three drugs, it's not a cocktail, so you don't have them all at the same time. They're in sequence. So the first drug is supposed to knock you out. It's an anesthetic. The second drug is supposed to paralyze you, and the third drug is supposed to sort of shut down your body, cause cardiac arrest. So the big problem is if that first drug doesn't knock the inmate out sufficiently, then the second and third drugs could potentially cause major pain and suffering, which is illegal. There's been lots of questions about what is an appropriate drug to use for that first in that first installment. So what the state used to use was a drug called midazolam, but when a major U.S. Supreme Court decision came out in January 2016, the death penalty was put on hold for a year and a half. So during that time, their stockpile of midazolam expired. And so the state had to figure out what it could use as a substitute because it couldn't get refills. This is a common problem that states have as manufacturers aren't very happy that states are using their what they consider life-saving drugs to be used to execute people. So it's very hard for states to get these drugs. So the state found a new drug called Etomidate that, again, has never been used before in a lethal injection in the United States, and that's what they used to execute Mark Assay.
So tell me a little bit more about the other drugs in the chain.
There's not as much controversy about the second and third drug because, they're going to cause cardiac arrest. They're going to cause pain regardless. So the major question is that first drug working? So there's no question about whether or not, you know, stopping your heart could potentially be painful. But how do we mask that pain? How do we sedate you? How do we put you under enough so that you don't feel that? So there was a lot less controversy about the third drug than there was about the first drug.
The last thing I want to ask you about is Mr. Assay himself. Tell me a little bit about him and the charge that he was convicted of, that he was put to death for.
Yeah, so he was put to death for two 1987 murders in Jacksonville. It was on the same night, separate incidents. His victims were Robert Booker and Robert McDowell. It's sort of unclear, what prompted this. In his justification, if we could even call it that, of killing Robert Booker, who was a black person. He used a racial epithet. So the prosecution painted him, Mr. Acey, as being a white supremacist, that this was racially motivated. The second victim, Robert McDowell, apparently had dressed up as a woman and was hired to provide oral sex when Mr. Acey shot him. There was some question about whether or not Mr. Acey knew this person from a drug sale gone wrong. So it's not totally clear, you know, what happened, but the prosecution really painted Mr. Acey as being very racially motivated. And it's interesting to point out that Florida, this execution was the first time Florida has executed a white person for killing a black person. And now, this is not uncommon across states that use the death penalty. Texas, Oklahoma, North Carolina, all of these states have the same pattern where it's very rare for a white person to be executed for killing a black person, which is not supported in the number of homicides that are committed by white people against black people. Also, in those cases where there are white people executed for killing a black person, many of them are avowed white supremacists. So this sort of falls into a pattern across the United States.
Thank you again for taking a few minutes to talk with us about the execution.
Of course, no problem.
That's Florida Public Radio's Nick Evans talking with WLRN reporter Wilson Sayer. Still to come on Capitol Report, Florida's Speaker of the House wants the state to stop using public money to fund political campaigns. Supporters argue the program encourages diverse candidates, but that's not always the case.
Maybe the time has come to say that public financing is just not viable.
Lawmakers are once again pushing for a bill that would let students replace learning foreign languages with computer languages.
This will be an important step forward in our state's need to integrate technology into our education curriculum.
And a beloved North Florida Republican lawmaker is remembered by his friends and former colleagues.
I don't know where to begin because he was one of a kind.
Florida lost a real gentleman, a true statesman, and I've lost a friend.
And if you needed someone in the foxhole with you, you couldn't find a better person than Greg Evers.
A House Republican leader this week filed a bill that likely will reopen a legislative debate about cracking down on what are called sanctuary cities. House Public Integrity and Ethics Chairman Larry Metz, a Republican from Yalaha, filed the bill for consideration during the 2018 legislative session, which starts in January. Last month, House Speaker Richard Corcoran issued a statement saying the House would revisit the controversial issue, which involves whether local governments cooperate with the federal government in enforcing immigration laws. The House during the 2017 session approved a bill aimed at ensuring local governments support immigration enforcement efforts, but a similar Senate bill was not taken up in committees. Metz's 21-page bill, in part, would bar local governments from having sanctuary policies and would direct them to support enforcement of immigration laws. Whether they know it or not, Florida taxpayers are funding certain statewide political campaigns. Supporters say the practice promotes diversity at the ballot box. But now the Speaker of the House is taking aim at the system. Kate Payne looks into who is actually benefiting from public financing.
Speaker of the House Richard Corcoran wants Florida to reverse its public financing of state elections. While he isn't running for statewide office, or at least not yet, his criticisms could change the calculus for those who are. Corcoran says the practice insulates the insider political class and takes away from school children and first responders.
The claim that public financing is welfare for politicians, that is a bit of an empty slogan.
Chara Torres-Spellacy teaches elections law at Stetson University.
You could also characterize it as fair fight funds for democracy.
In Florida, eligible candidates for governor and cabinet seats can qualify for matching funds from the state.
The state will match a small contribution from a Florida donor up to $250. The candidate who accepts public financing also has to agree to an expenditure limit.
Torres Spellacy says too many candidates get caught in a downward spiral of weak fundraising.
It's totally frustrating because, you know, these are doctors and lawyers and professors, and they are just seen as not serious candidates merely because of money.
Public financing is supposed to counteract that. The idea caught on with a certain presidential candidate in 2016.
Unless we move to public funding of elections, young people will continue to have to beg campaign funds from the rich and the powerful. That I want to see end.
That was U.S. Senator Bernie Sanders. But in Florida, in practice, underdog candidates from diverse backgrounds aren't the ones making bank, partly because candidates have to clear a baseline before they're eligible. Cabinet contenders have to raise $100,000, and those running for governor have to raise $150,000. Democratic Senator Perry Thurston says that's disqualifying some of the candidates who need the money most.
Maybe the amount could be lowered in terms of what a candidate has to raise before they have matching funds.
Thurston ran against incumbent Pam Bondi in 2014 for the attorney general seat. Bondi racked up $328,000 in state matching funds alone, outstripping the amount Thurston raised in his entire campaign. In past races, Bondi and Agriculture Commissioner Adam Putnam raised millions with the help of public funds, while some of their competitors struggled to scrape together $100,000. Despite the eligibility issue, Thurston stands by the goal of public financing.
I think the government would be better served if we could have an actual debate about the ideas instead of saying who can raise the most money. That's not always how you get your best representation.
But some challengers turn down the public money, even when they do qualify.
Let me first say it was a matter of a tremendous debate within my campaign.
That's former chief financial officer and one-time governor's candidate Alex Sink, a Democrat. She says she didn't take public funds in 2010 because of the severity of the Great Recession. Sink says there was a time when the system was viable and the public understood
that money is king in campaigns, and that unless you had a system to level the playing field, if you will, or limit the amount of money that could be spent, that we were going to end up in a free-for-all.
Flash forward to 2017.
And actually, that's where we are now. We're in a free-for-all. We weren't anticipating.
The 2010 U.S. Supreme Court decision, Citizens United, lifted the limits on private spending. Sink says that flood of so-called dark money makes public financing indefensible. $2 million of taxpayer funds and a $50 million governor's race won't make a bit of difference, she says.
And with so many critical needs in our state, education's underfunded, transportation's underfunded, I personally think that I agree with Speaker Corcoran that maybe the time has...
At the writing of this story, only Republican Matt Caldwell, candidate for Ag Commissioner, has announced he won't take taxpayer funding. The 2018 hopefuls have until June to make a final decision. It remains to be seen whether public financing will make a difference at the ballot box. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Kate Payne.
A Florida lawmaker is once again pushing to increase computer programming education in schools, as we hear from Regan McCarthy.
St. Petersburg Republican Senator Jeff Brandis has filed a measure for the upcoming legislative session that would let students fulfill their language requirements by learning coding. It's not the first time he's filed the measure. He introduced a similar bill to the Senate Education Committee last session.
The bill requires that Florida colleges and institutions and state universities recognize computer courses as a foreign language.
And that's something Ethan Greenberg, a sixth grader at Silver Trail Middle School in Pembroke Pines, Florida, says could really help him.
Since I started school, I had a hard time writing. It was very messy and nobody could read it. Later, I was told I had dysgraphia. It is a learning disability that causes difficulty with written expression. I can't form letters and numbers well when writing them.
Ethan says using a computer presented a way to overcome his dysgraphia. And Ethan's mom, Ryan, points out the measure creates an opportunity for students to exercise choice when it comes to their education.
When kids have a choice, they come to the classroom excited to learn and more than likely will get a good grade in the class they choose. This will be an important step forward in our state's need to integrate technology into our education curriculum.
But world language experts say computer languages are not equal to human languages. Jackie Bronke told lawmakers she represents Florida foreign language teachers.
Computer coding is not a communicative language between human beings with its own culture.
Bronke and others worry about what the change could mean for foreign language departments and point out the potential loss of incentive for students to become bilingual. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
You're listening to Capitol Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, the memorial service as well as the funeral for former Senator Greg Evers is planned for next week. The North Florida Republican lawmaker died this past Monday in a single car wreck when his pickup truck crashed through a guardrail near his home in Baker. Now, as Sasha Cordner reports, some of his colleagues and friends are taking time to remember Evers and the legislative legacy he left behind.
I'm Greg Evers. Our values are different around here. If Washington were run by Panhandle values, our country would be in a better place.
Surrounded by a field of land on his farm with a farm tractor behind him, Greg Evers last year released his first TV ad in his bid to represent the 1st Congressional District. In the ad, the Baker Republican, who'd previously served in the Florida legislature for 16 years, says he's a fifth-generation Floridian from the Northwest area, a farmer, and a small businessman. While he also called himself a lifetime member of the National Rifle Association, past NRA president and lobbyist Marion Hammer calls Evers a great friend. She says she's known him since he first ran for office.
You don't see a lot of folks like Greg Evers anymore. He was a farmer. He was a down-to-earth, straight shooter and a strong, strong advocate for the Second Amendment. Gun owners, and in fact many, many people throughout this state, are going to miss him and his honesty and his integrity.
Included in the gun laws Evers helped put on the Florida books is the so-called warning shot bill. It removed 10/20 life as a penalty for aggravated assault cases. The goal was to make sure a person did not receive a 20-year minimum mandatory prison sentence for firing a warning shot in self-defense. Still, Hammer says Evers should be remembered for even more than that.
That, in my mind, is irrelevant to the imprint that he left on the hearts and minds of people that he worked with. You didn't just work with Greg Evers. He made you a friend. And that kind of legacy, I think, is unbeatable.
But Evers wasn't just known for his pro-gun views. His work in Florida's criminal justice system, particularly with the Florida's prison system, also drew praise. Former Republican Senator, now Pasco County tax collector, Mike Fasano calls Evers, quote, a tireless advocate for his constituents, many of whom were correctional officers. Fasano recalls a time when they both worked alongside a few of their GOP colleagues and Democrats to kill prison privatization efforts years ago.
And he made those people, those individuals, a priority of his. And through his efforts, we were successful in stopping many of the movements by others to privatize prisons. He made certain that his constituents, his correctional officers, were well taken care of as far as making sure that they were recognized and appreciated throughout the state.
In recent years, Evers worked to help address the understaffing levels at Florida's prisons in the Florida Senate. He also advocated on behalf of correctional officers receiving pay raises. But his advocacy didn't stop there. He also authored legislation to help protect inmates as well. Florida's prison system has undergone a slew of secretaries and was plagued at the time by suspicious inmate deaths and allegations of inmate abuse.
All this is to try to legislate
common sense. Even though we've got them incarcerated, they have to do their time, you know, but we still, we have to treat that person with some dignity, yes.
And Fleming Island Republican Senator Rob Bradley, who sat on several criminal justice committees with Evers, says it's one of the things he really liked about his former colleague.
He had in his heart a desire to really help people that were forgotten. I miss him, and you know, his family is in my thoughts and prayers.
Evers' friendships also transcended party lines. Former Senate Democratic leader Arthenia Joyner, who like Evers left the Florida legislature last year, says she too worked with him on prison reform issues. And she says their friendship dates back way before then.
And that was so evident that after we both left and when he was running for Congress, he called and we talk about the campaign periodically. You know, it's devastating to me because I had a very close relationship with both he and Lori.
Joyner remembers when Evers first got elected in 2001 to the Florida House during a special election. She recalls teasing him a bit for his freshman status.
And so we told him we would teach him the ways of the Capitol, beginning with where the bathroom was. And there was a lot of laughter and fun, and we just developed a cool relationship from that point on. And he, every time I introduced him to somebody, he'd tell them I'm her favorite redneck.
That's Evers' fellow North Floridian, Bill Monford, another Democrat and current senator. Monford says when he first was elected to the Senate in 2010, Evers took him under his wing.
Greg was one of the first ones that came to me and said, if I can ever be of help to you, or if you want to team up on an issue, he would say, I'm your man. Greg is kind of friend that I would call a robust friend, if you will. Robust in the sense that, you know, he was always there to help, eager to help. And he could be depended upon. He's a man of great integrity.
And Monford says while Evers was no longer in the legislature, his absence will still be felt as the Senate was a better body with him in it. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Kortner.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Jim Ash, Sasha Kordner, Nick Evans, Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, and Kate Payne. We also thank our contributing Florida Public Radio stations. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Ken Smith, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at FBRCapReport. And join us next week at this time for more reports from the State Capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows at fprn.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following: The Able Trust, dedicated to connecting businesses and workers with disabilities. Businesses are encouraged to recruit, interview, and hire talented and loyal Floridians with disabilities as they seek to broaden their customer base and reach all of Florida's diverse population. Abletrust.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.